Welcome to a very special presentation of the novel A Really Good Day by James Hosek. On its surface, it's a story about a remarkable round of golf. But if you're not a golfer, if you quickly change the channel, if you accidentally come upon a tournament on TV, I encourage you to listen anyway. It's a story about family and friendship. It's a story about redemption and second chances. It's a story about promises made and promises kept. It's a story about once-in-a-lifetime experiences. But most of all, it is one man's love letter to his family. That man was my brother, the author, James Hosek. Aside from being an amazing veterinarian, woodworker, gardener, husband, father, brother, son, and friend, he was a writer. Writers are often told to write what they know. And in this, his first book, he did that in more ways than I can count. It will make you laugh. It will make you cry. And it will make you stand up and cheer. So sit back and enjoy as Jim takes you on a fun, entertaining journey through 18 holes of golf and one man's really good day. Chapter 6, Fourth Hole. The path to the fourth tee followed an asphalt cart path through a copse of leafy trees. The sun was just starting to warm things up a bit, and Scott reminded himself to take a drink from his water bottle. He handed it back to Paul, who also squirted a slug down the back of his throat and tucked it back in the golf bag. The joy of his last birdie was almost enough to remove the anxiety that was creeping in again. He stopped as he emerged from the trees and looked to his left. Another water hole. This time, the water ran along the left side of the fairway of a medium-length par 4 hole. It was a dogleg to the left, meaning that the fairway took a bend about halfway to the hole, requiring the first shot to be placed pretty well to be in a good position to make the green in two shots. To make things worse, a series of sand traps lined the middle of the fairway on the right side, at the bend of the dogleg. A tee shot hit too far would be on the beach, as opposed to the water. But a sand trap was always preferable to the water, since you usually had a chance to hit the ball back into play again. This fairway would certainly be a challenge to Scott. What he was most worried about was his tendency to slice the ball. Good golfers could control their tee shots to some degree and have the ball go straight, curve left or right at will. Scott was not one of those golfers. If anything, his balls either sliced, like it had on the second tee, or pulled a little to the right, neither of which would help him on this hole. Paul handed Scott his 3-wood. Wood was definitely a misnomer, since all of Scott's clubs were metal. When he first started out with his flea market clubs, he had used actual woods. The club heads were a solid chunk of carved wood, attached to a steel shaft with a metal plate screwed onto the face. They had served him well for many years. For his 30th birthday, Scott had treated himself to a decent set of clubs with metal woods, and had instantly liked the control and distance the modern clubs gave him. Scott didn't see wooden clubs sold anymore, but he remembered reading about a club maker in Arizona or New Mexico who still made wooden clubs for a few clients who preferred them. Scott looked at the club. If anything, his 3-wood sliced more than his driver. "Are you sure?" "You don't want to get in those sand traps, Scott," answered Paul. "It'll leave me a long shot to the green." "Trust me," answered Paul. Scott decided to take Paul's advice this time. His friend had been golfing longer than Scott, and had played enough with him to know what he was capable of. On this, he would take his caddy's advice. "Mr. Hanover still has honors," announced the red-jacketed official. Despite the coolness of the day, the overweight man seemed to be uncomfortably warm in the jacket. A little sweat wetted the sideburns on either side of his balding head. Scott placed his ball and tee in the ground, this time setting the ball just a little bit above the ground. He was used to hitting his 3-wood off the fairway, and if he teed it up like he would with his driver, chances were he'd hit under the ball, sending it farther up than out. He lined up with a spot he figured was halfway to the green. The ball would roll diagonally across the green and hopefully stop short of the sand trap. He lined up and waited. Nothing. Not a sound. He turned to look at Paul, but instead caught the lens of the camera woman's camera, staring at him. Everyone was waiting for him to hit. He felt stupid, but he figured it worked on the last hole. It might help now. But no one seemed to get it. "Anyone want to say anything?" he asked. A confused expression seemed to multiply over the faces of the onlookers. Ellie let her camera fall, and her face brightened with a smile. "Are you sure?" she asked.
"What are you doing, Mr. Hanover?" inquired the official with no small amount of annoyance.
"Hey, every golfer has his quirks. In my case, my quirk is more of a quack."
"What?" demanded the official. Ellie stood straight, smiled, then looked Scott square in the face.
"Quack!" she exclaimed.
Scott laughed.
"Thank you."
He looked over at Paul, who shrugged sheepishly.
"Sorry, Scott," said Paul.
He gave a quiet, apologetic quack, and Scott felt the tension melt into fun. That was why he was here anyway, wasn't it?
"Ah,"
muttered the official, his annoyance now full-blown with disgust. Scott took his practice swings, getting the feel of the slightly shorter shaft and weight of the club compared to his driver. He stepped closer and whacked the ball with the satisfying plink that a metal wood made when it hit perfectly. The ball soared left of where he aimed, but then turned slightly to the right. It landed in the middle of the fairway and bounced towards the sand traps on the far side. It rolled to a stop in the rough between two of the sand traps. He was farther from the hole than he wanted, but he wasn't wet, and he wasn't on the beach. Not too bad, considering. Jerry Spalding took the tee next. He had his driver, and was likely a golfer who could give his shot that needed hook and send it curving left along the dogleg to the 150-yard marker. With his customary speed, he pulled the club back and whacked it as hard as Scott had seen anyone whack a ball. He aimed further to the left than Scott would have dared, and the ball curved further to the left than Jerry had intended. Spalding knew the result of his drive without having to see the ball splash in the far end of the water hazard. Unlike the last hole, his temper showed, and he smacked the club onto the tee. The red-jacketed man raised his eyebrows at the display, and announced with a satisfied tone,
"Mr. Spalding is now hitting 3.
Once again, he had received a penalty for hitting into a water hazard. He would have to count a stroke for his drive and want to get the ball back on the tee to hit again. He placed another tee in the ground and a ball atop it. Paul noticed the ball was slightly higher than before. He looked at Spalding's caddy, who seemed oblivious to the mistake. Paul shrugged and watched the angry golfer wind up again. This time, the ball not only went straight, but it went high, like a pop fly to center field. Except it wasn't a tobacco-chewing center fielder in pinstripes and a baseball cap with a glove waiting for the easy catch, but one of the sand traps. A puff of sand erupted around the ball, and Jerry's temper erupted again as well. Another dent was added to the ground, and he stomped off to his caddy. He quietly growled at the frightened kid, obviously assigning him the blame for not noticing Jerry had misteed the ball. Pete Baldwin approached the tee box calmly. He set his ball. Scott noticed he had an iron, probably a 4 or a 5. He hit the ball with a little draw to the left, and it landed in the middle of the fairway where Scott had hoped his shot would have landed.
"Nice shot," complimented Scott.
"Thanks,"
answered Pete. He handed his club to his caddy, who had come up behind him, leading the group to the fairway.
"I wouldn't mind being there with you."
I wouldn't mind having your score right now, answered Pete.
Scott nodded. He really had nothing to complain about at this point.
Scott would shoot first, as he was still the furthest from the hole. As they walked out to his ball, he and Paul whispered to each other.
Boy, that Spalding guy doesn't seem to be having any fun, said Scott.
He should have noticed how high his ball was, said Paul.
Can't blame the caddy for everything.
Does that mean I can blame you for some things? Asked Scott.
I'll let you know, answered Paul.
What am I hitting here?
Well, with this tall grass, you probably should stick with an iron. You'll likely be short of the green, but with a good chip, you could make par. Definitely bogey.
Bogey would be fine. I'm already 2 under par.
I can afford a few shots here and there, said Scott.
He truly would be happy with a 5 on this hole. Any score under 81 today would be a great achievement in his mind.
He had once shot a 76, but on that day he hadn't started out nearly as well as he had today.
Paul eyed the distance to the hole and handed Scott the 4-iron.
Your 3-iron will be too low. Better to get up and on the fairway and be short.
No problem, answered Scott.
The ball was sitting in a 4-yard area of tall cut grass, or rough, between 2 sand traps on the right side of the fairway. Jerry's ball was in the trap closer to the hole and sitting pretty deep in the sand. Scott swung a few times in the tall grass, getting the feel for the way it would grab his club head as he hit the ball.
Closer to the hole, he thought. Just hit it closer to the hole.
There were rare occasions when a shot took him further away, like when he missed a downhill putt, and the ball rolled twice as far away from the hole than he started, or if he hit the ball with the edge of the club on a chip shot, sending it sailing to the opposite side of the green. Once he had seen Paul send a ball rolling up the trunk of a tree he was trying to shoot around. It shot straight up into the air and ended up 2 yards behind him. Scott had about 250 yards to the hole, and the best he could hit a 4-iron was maybe 210 when he got a good shot off the fairway. If he got 190 out of this grass, leaving only a medium chip shot to the green, he'd be grateful. He lined up his club and took a deep breath. He tried not to think about the whole swing, just where he wanted the club to be on his backswing, where he wanted to be after he hit the ball, facing the green and watching it sail in the air. He imagined it landing in front of the green. He didn't need to think about everything in between. His muscles and bones had been through enough golf shots to have that part memorized. He would let them do their work. 9 times out of 10, they would do just fine. Well, 8 times out of 10. 7. He brought the club back with a relaxed ease and fixed his eyes on a spot in front of the ball. The club swooshed through the grass and picked the ball up into the air, leaving a little shaved patch of sod. It soared and headed to the right. It was closer to the hole, maybe 50 or 60 yards away, but not on the fairway. He hoped he was in a good position to have a decent chip shot to get near the hole, at least onto the green. Paul patted his shoulder as he took the club.
Excellent shot, Scott, he said.
Thanks, answered Scott half-heartedly.
No, really, added Paul. You got it up and out and...
They both finished the sentence.
Closer to the hole.
It could have been on the fairway, said Scott.
Fairway schmairway. It could have been in the trees, retorted Paul.
Glass half full, my friend.
Glass half full.
Scott smiled, and they stepped onto the fairway while Jerry Spalding took his club into the sand trap. Sand traps on George Dunn had steep edges cut into the turf and were slightly lower than the surrounding grass at the edge. Too low a shot, and Jerry would run his ball straight into the dirt, and it would likely roll back where he started. The problem was, his ball was sitting halfway down into the sand. He would need a sand wedge or a high iron if he hoped to get it out. A sand wedge wouldn't hit the ball as far, but its leading edge was designed to blast through the sand and get the club under the ball. Jerry was already lying 3 after his first tee shot went into the water.
It would be nice to get it close to the green. But if he was smart, he'd just work on getting it out of the trap, and then to the green, and hope to make up the lost shots on later holes. He grabbed what appeared to be a 7-iron from his bag, ignoring the sand wedge held by the caddy. He was not playing smart. The 7-iron might get him a few yards more, but it would have a tough time getting the ball out of the pit it was in. Jerry let the club hover over the sand. Touching the club to the sand while addressing the ball was an automatic penalty. He pulled it back in a full backswing and blasted it into the trap. A spray of sand shot from the club head as he brought it down into the trap, and Scott and Paul were not at all that surprised when the ball popped up and moved about 1 foot forward. The sand had gone much farther than that. Before he could stop himself, Jerry's temper flared one more time, and he smashed his club into the sand and froze. His shoulders slumped, and he slowly turned to look over his right shoulder at the red-jacketed man behind him. He held up 2 fingers of his right hand. Jerry had just been assessed a 2-stroke penalty for letting his club touch the sand when not hitting the ball. Not only was Jerry still in the trap, but he had also used a total of 6 strokes. Still, he was a little closer to the hole, thought Scott. Humbled and disappointed at his position, he walked out of the trap and exchanged his 7-iron for the sand wedge. The ball was now at least lying on top of the sand. He easily hit it out onto the fairway. He walked out of the trap, shaking his head, angry at himself for potentially blowing a good round. The best he was looking at was a 9, maybe an 8. For this hole, a score not unfamiliar to Scott and Paul. The group walked up to Pete's ball. He hit a beautiful shot that landed him on the front of the green. A challenging 1-putt, but an easy 2 putts from the hole. Jerry was next to shoot again. He whispered with his caddy and took an iron from him. With more slowness than before, he addressed the ball lying on the fairway. He took no practice swings, but seemed to be in less of a hurry than before. He swung the club and the ball took off, a small divot airborne after it, and made it to the green. But then it rolled off the back, ending up 12 or 13 yards out. After 8 strokes, he was still not on the green. Scott felt sorry for him. He had been there many times. He hoped his ball would make the green. Scott and Paul found the ball with the yellow duck emblazoned on it off the right side of the fairway. The grass was a little shorter here than on his last shot, but longer than the fairway. The chip shot required a partial backswing. As it was well inside the distance, he usually hit his pitching wedge. He figured a half backswing would do it, and practiced it 3 times to get the rhythm. It felt right, but as he often found, his practice swing and the real swing at the ball didn't always match up. Paul had often suggested he use his practice swing to hit the ball. Scott pointed out then that it wouldn't be his practice swing. He moved his feet 6 inches closer to the ball, then pulled the club back to where he judged halfway to be and easily swung it at his ball. It lifted out of the grass, but headed more to the left than he had aimed. A break in the green helped it roll towards the hole, and he ended up less than a yard away. "Doable," muttered Paul excitedly. "Doable," echoed Scott. A speckle of applause acknowledged the shot. As Scott looked around, he thought that maybe the crowd following them had grown. Why people would want to come see them golf was beyond his comprehension, unless they were just killing time until the good players started later in the morning. Jerry was still off the green, so he hit next. With even more caution, he actually took a few practice swings. Despite the disaster his hole was turning into for him, he was determined to finish it with minimal embarrassment. Jerry stepped up to his ball. Scott noticed the buzz from a small airplane growing louder overhead. He would have stepped back and waited for it to pass, rather than have the noise interfere with his concentration. More often than not, Little distractions like that tended to affect his shots more than he thought they should. Jerry seemed unaffected. A grim expression of determination twisted his face, and he took a little backswing and pulled the club under the ball. What happened next had happened to Scott more than once in the past. But for Jerry, it was more icing on the cake. His pitching wedge slid under the ball on the slick grass. The ball popped up just enough to land on the club face again before bouncing onto the green. Jerry stood frozen, his eyes closed, a glimmer of wetness in the corners. Each time the ball hit the club, it was counted as a stroke. What's more, he received one more penalty stroke for hitting the ball twice with one swing. He was lying 10 yards from the hole. If there was ever a time to smash his club into the ground or throw it into a tree or into the water, this was it. Not a single person gathered around the hole would blame him now. He held his temper this time and slowly shook his head. Then a strange thing happened. He started to laugh. It was a light chuckle at first, like when you saw a funny bumper sticker. Then it grew. His chuckle became a staccato laugh that seemed to grow stronger with every breath. His caddy, who had been trying to hold in his own amusement for fear of wrath from his boss, started chortling as well. The contagious mirth swept through the group, and soon everyone around the green was laughing with Jerry. It was a hole he certainly would remember, and a story that would be told by everyone witnessing it for years to come. He took his wedge to his caddy. The caddy pulled out Jerry's driver. He laughed more, and eventually the caddy pulled out the putter. The laughter had died, and the mood lightened significantly. "In the hole!" shouted one of the spectators as he lined up his putt. "Quiet, please," said the red-jacketed official, whose own face now matched his jacket, as he wiped at a few tears on his cheeks left from his own laughter. Jerry hit the putt lightly, letting the downhill slope of the green do most of the work. The ball moved at a slow, even pace and twisted along the slight, almost imperceptible undulations of the green, as if he had planned the perfect shot. It headed straight for the hole, but decided at the last second to veer a little to the right, rim around the cup, and end up 4 inches away from the hole towards Jerry. He was shaking his head, not at all surprised at the last bit of defiance the small white orb showed him. He popped it into the hole, and to a small bit of token applause, pulled it out, stared at it, and with a sudden burst, threw it into the water hazard where it plopped neatly to join his first shot. He handed his putter to his caddy, put an arm around the boy's shoulder, and they walked off the green to enthusiastic applause. Pete replaced his ball marker with his ball and carefully lined up his putt. It ended up 6 inches short and a little to the left, but he parred the hole with little effort and little fanfare. It was hard to gloat when one of your playing partners just finished with a 13. Scott placed his ball down and picked up his tiny Cayman Islands penny. It was copper with a picture of Queen Elizabeth on one side and 1 cent written on the other. It was perhaps half the size of an American penny, and just the perfect size for a ball marker. He stepped back and carefully looked at the lay of the green. It should go straight in. "Straight in," said Paul behind him, as if he was reading his mind. He stood up and took his practice swings, gauging the right speed. He didn't let his eyes fix on the hole itself. That was too big a target. Instead, he looked at a little blade of grass that was poking up a few millimeters at the edge of the hole right in the middle of where he wanted it to go in. He stepped up, let his eyes trace the path a few times, and popped the ball. It went straight and fell into the cup, rolling right over that blade of grass. He let out his breath. He tried to remember how many times he had shot a 13 when first starting out. Plenty. Even nowadays, a 9 or 10 wasn't out of question on a pretty bad hole. Today, it looked like he was going to have mostly good ones. Jake was confused. He had looked everywhere. Not only couldn't he find Patterson, but Karen Blakely had disappeared as well. Could she have found him first? Where were they? He stopped in front of the scoreboard just as the scorekeeper was posting the latest results. There were about 18 golfers with holes played so far, and the old man in the yellow shirt and slacks was being kept very busy with reports on his walkie-talkie every few minutes. Hanover still held the lead, but by only one stroke, and there were half a dozen players right behind him. One player had required a special card, a 3 with a 1 drawn in front of it with a magic marker. A 13. He was probably out of it for sure. His running total showed him shooting 10 over par for the first 4 holes, a big deficit to overcome. In Jake's inside pocket, he felt the crinkle of the contract paper, a 1-year term with exclusive rights to the athlete for Frazier and Frakes. He had found a copy in his desk in his apartment, buried beneath a stack of mail and magazines that were not bills but hadn't been important enough to demand his attention. Once he had a signature on it, Jonathan would take over and negotiate the Callaway deal. He had asked 20 people if they had seen Patterson, and no one had for the last half hour. He kicked himself for not running after him when he saw the golfer earlier in the morning. He had hoped that any information he had gotten from Eric Peters would help him accomplish that goal. In reality, it seemed to give Patterson a chance to give Jake the slip. Now, it was a race. Karen Blakely would say and promise anything to get Patterson to sign with her, even if she couldn't deliver it. It was her style. It was then up to the other people, like April Weinstein, to deal with the complaints later from the athlete and try to get them to forget previous promises with actual deals, usually not as big as promised. It was a body game for Karen. She wanted to sign as many as possible and take her commissions. The more athletes she signed, the better chance that one of them might strike it big someday and take Karen with them. Jake preferred to find someone to fit a niche and ensure a good fit with his or her sponsor. He found himself back in the dining area of the clubhouse and considered his situation. He hadn't really been thinking clearly since he'd seen Karen earlier and needed to work out his options at this point. What if she had signed Patterson? What could Jake do then? He stopped by a television and noted that it was tuned to the coverage of some race, probably a marathon since it was taking place on city streets. Chicago city streets. Of course, he realized, today was the Chicago Marathon. Usually, all the top runners at those events were signed with someone and appeared in print ads and running magazines. Feet adorned with logo shoes. Jason Bernard was standing beneath the screen as well, shaking his head, sipping at a coffee cup that had stopped steaming.
Kenyans? Asked Jake.
No, some high school kid with an early lead. Now that's a kid who'll need an agent, he suggested.
Jake realized that Jason was right. Who would have thought that a no-name would take an early lead in one of the top marathon events in the country? He briefly considered getting in his car, driving as close to the finish line as possible, and trying to be the first to shove contract and pen under the kid's face. Then a thought occurred to him.
High school, you said?
Yeah, a junior out of Morton High School in Berwyn. His first marathon race. The kid's a natural. It'll top the news if he makes a good showing.
You don't think he'll win?
Not unless he has nitrous tanks in his calves. He can't keep that pace. His inexperience will take its toll after the halfway point. When he hits the wall around 20 miles, he's going to hit it hard.
The wall was the place in the race runners came to where they felt like they couldn't take another step. It was part physical, part mental, and only the toughest and best trained could keep going once they reached it. You had to push yourself beyond what you thought you were capable of doing, and then push some more. The interesting thing about the kid being in high school was that he wouldn't be able to sign a contract for another year until he was 18. His parents would have to be the ones to agree to representation. If Jake could find them before someone else.
Then a particularly devious thought hit him.
Was it worth a shot? He grabbed some change from his pocket and headed back to the phone outside the clubhouse. He dropped 2 quarters in and called Jonathan once again.
Jake, where are you?
Jonathan asked with slight apprehension.
At the course, of course.
Jake heard Jonathan sigh with relief.
Have you signed Patterson?
Can't find him.
Jake, you have to. You need this.
Hey, I know that. You don't think I can?
No, no,
interrupted Jonathan.
I know you can do it, but why are you calling?
If you'd let me get a word in, I'll tell you.
All right, I'm listening.
Have you been following the marathon?
There's 6 of us watching it on the television in the conference room, answered Jonathan.
Is April Weinstein there?
Yeah, why?
Who's out there trying to get him?
Hey, that's more than I can swing for you, buddy.
Not me. Listen, he's a minor, right?
I hadn't thought of that.
Probably no one has. He can't even sign a contract to hammer a nail, right?
Right.
Well, if April Weinstein thinks there's an advantage by sending someone to meet the kid's parents rather than the kid, they can sign him long before the race is finished.
I'm not getting it.
Who would she send?
Well, normally Karen, but she's out there with...
Are you getting it?
If Karen smells a bigger fish, she'll leave Patterson to you.
Bingo!
You're a genius, Jake.
Thank you. Once she's gone, that'll leave Patterson wide open for me.
I'll do my best.
Jonathan was silent for a moment.
I called Gina, he said. I was worried.
I probably gave you reason to be worried. I was angry.
And you had every right to be. But she's on her way there.
It was Jake's turn to be silent.
What did she say?
She'd come out to make sure you were okay and let you borrow her cell phone.
Jake laughed at the remark.
Well, to tell you the truth, a few minutes ago I was wishing she was here. Do you think my plan might work?
I'll put the bug in Weinstein's ear. Call me later.
Okay.
The operator interrupted, asking for more money, but Jake just hung up. Now he'd wait. Karen Blakely listened intently on her cell phone as April Weinstein outlined the situation. 2 clients in a day. It was going to be a very good day for her. She pressed the end button and slipped the slim phone back into her purse.
Who was that?
Asked her companion.
Oh, my boss. Just calling to make sure the best amateur player in Chicago is on our team.
I must say, Miss Blakely, I am somewhat flattered that you came out here to sign me.
His pipe had gone out a while ago, but he still held it. When he had heard her coming along the path from the clubhouse, he was at first angry that his solitude had been disturbed. But her offer and the paper she produced did a lot to move her to his good side.
Of course, this contract obligates you to representation from myself and my boss, April Weinstein.
Of course, answered Andrew.
I will leave you be, she said, but I'll be right here when you win to make sure we get you some face time on the evening news. USA Sports is covering it, you know.
Yes, I heard.
She smiled and turned back towards the clubhouse. He was totally a geek, and his outfit looked like something Rodney Dangerfield would piece together. But she had him. Jake Fisher could choke on her dust. She checked her watch. She had an hour to make it downtown. It could be done. April was emailing her a picture of the kid's parents to her phone. These things were marvelous inventions, she thought, as she lightly tapped her purse appreciatively. She loved having every edge she could. But when it came to Fisher, it was no competition at all. Sarah had moved the crib to several locations in the baby's room, trying to find the absolute best spot, and it ended up right where it had started. There were other things to do in here, like setting up the closed-circuit camera they had bought and putting outlet protectors in the plugs. She knew the latter wouldn't be a necessity for a year or so, but being prepared wasn't a motto reserved just for the Boy Scouts. A month earlier, she and her sister had painted the room. The ceiling was sky blue, with puffy cotton ball clouds swirling around like a warm summer day. On the walls were a series of murals, depicting scenes from A.A. Milne's 100 Acre Woods. Perhaps someday the kid would want it painted over with racing cars or spaceships if it was a boy, or ponies or flowers if it was a girl, or maybe something not so stereotypical, like an underwater scene or a beach with palm trees. A ringing phone interrupted her thoughts, and she went back to the living room and picked up the portable phone from the living room coffee table. "Hello," she answered.
"Hi, it's me," said her sister.
"Hi, Anna, what's up?"
"It may be too late to get anything good, but that huge rummage sale at Northfield is today. Interested in going?"
"That's today?" asked Sarah. She had been to the huge sale before with Anna, and knew that there were veteran sale hunters camped out for hours before the doors opened to make sure they were first to get in.
"Yeah, with getting Linus off the camp and Dale driving me crazy while he tried to get his presentation in order, it slipped my mind. Even if we're too late for anything good, I could use a trip out of the house," she said.
"Well, I'm kind of in the mood for a little celebrating myself. I just finished putting the baby script together," she answered proudly.
"I thought Scott was going to do that."
"He was, but he's out golfing, and I just did it. It wasn't that hard," she confided, leaving out the part about having to do it twice. Maybe she'd tell her later.
"Him and his golfing. Why do you let him do that?"
"Well, partly because it's nice to have him gone for a few hours once a week, and partly to build up a little guilt so I can get him to do other things for me."
"Like put the crib together?" commented Anna sarcastically.
"No, like mowing the lawn and fixing the fence gate and cleaning the gutters. After a round of golf, he feels more obligated to do some work around the house than if I just nag him."
"I guess I can see your point," agreed Anna.
"Anyway, I'll be there in 10 minutes. We'll go out for lunch at that new Chinese place on Main afterward. I haven't been able to get Dale to take me there yet, and I've been begging for 2 months.
"Sounds good. I'll clear out the trunk of the car and we'll be set."
"Oh, I'm so glad I called," said her sister excitedly.
"Me too. See you."
She pressed the talk button to hang up the phone. She turned off the CD player and, for fun, flipped the television back on. They were still covering the marathon, and now it appeared other stations had picked up the coverage. She listened as the announcers marveled at the young kid's ability to keep an unprecedented pace. They were beginning to believe his inexperience was paying off. A group of veteran racers were now a quarter of a mile behind him, and he seemed to be widening the gap every few minutes. They were quick to point out that the race was far from over. But it certainly would be a day that many people in Chicago would remember for a long time to come. They weren't far from the truth. Another spasm of muscle contractions hit Sarah's abdomen. She took a few deep breaths, and it passed quickly. She was quite sure it wasn't labor, but still considered calling Anna to cancel their outing, just in case. As she considered it further, she figured she might as well go. The baby still had a few more weeks to cook, and if something did happen, she wouldn't be alone. Ted Lang was enjoying his morning at the tournament. A back injury prevented him from swinging his clubs competitively, but he did like to teach others the game that had consumed 6 decades of his life. He had first sneaked his dad's clubs out of the garage to the empty lot across the street when he was 12. He had lost every single one of the balls his dad had in the bag in the tall grass. Most of his shots went wild, but maybe 1 out of 10 he sent soaring. His father didn't find out about Ted's unauthorized usage until he went to play golf that weekend and noted all the balls were gone. Instead of getting angry, he bought his son a second-hand set of clubs and a bag of used balls from the pro shop at the country club and presented them to his son. He had many great memories of golf outings with his dad, who instead of getting irate at losing $5 worth of balls,
recognized Ted's love for the game and fostered it into a pro career. His dad had died of a heart attack at 39 and had never seen Ted play professionally. But he was always on Ted's mind, offering silent suggestions as he played, bringing unprovoked smiles to his face. Ted loved watching amateur tournaments. When the Northern Illinois Golf Association asked him to help at this event, he was excited for the chance to meet the golfers as they warmed up. He had attended some of the local qualifying tournaments and felt lucky to still be involved with the game after his injury. He glanced at his watch. There were another 10 minutes of his break left before he had to head back to the driving range, and he was interested in seeing how the field was doing so far. As he wandered up by the clubhouse, he found Joe Culkin, a former student of his, studying the scoreboard as it was being updated.
"Joe, sorry to hear about your wrist. Tough break," he joked.
"I haven't heard that one 100 times, answered Joe.
"Can't wait until I'm finished at the driving range. I can get out on the course and watch. Where's the action?"
"I'd say the 5th hole.
"The 5th hole?
Joe pointed to the top 10 player section and the name and score of the first place player. Hanover S, -2, -4.
"The fellow who took your place, eh?"
"That's the one," answered Joe.
"He's having a good morning?" asked Ted.
"Great so far. He's ranked last, you know."
"I know. I got to meet him this morning."
"You didn't do your old shoelace thing, did you?" inquired Joe.
"You know me all too well," answered Ted. "He's got a good game somewhere in him."
"Well, it looks like it's oozing out today," agreed Joe.
"Is that what I think it is?" asked Ted, pointing at the altered number 3 card on the board.
"Yep, a non-tuple bogey, I believe," he laughed.
"Well, there really are bad holes in all of us, my friend. I can't remember the last time I had a 13, but if I play long enough, I'll see it again."
"We'll have to see if Hanover can hold the lead, especially once the top 12 rated guys get out there."
"Patterson is supposed to have the game to take it," commented Ted.
"I'm betting not today," said Joe.
Ted turned to look at him.
"You bet against Andrew Patterson?"
"Worse," he continued. "I bet against Andrew Patterson with Andrew Patterson."
"Aye,"
cried Ted.
"Well, maybe the young Mr. Hanover can dig you out of that one. Patterson will probably shoot in the high 60s.
Oh, wait, here comes Hanover's group scores for 5.
The yellow-shirted scorekeeper pulled a green card from his stack and laid it on the hook next to Scott Hanover's name under the column for the 5th hole. Karen Blakely was walking quickly to the parking lot. She couldn't go too fast due to her high heels and too tight skirt, but she seemed in a definite hurry. Jake couldn't tell where she had come from. She reached her car and held out a key fob. The car alarm was disabled with a beep, and she opened the driver's side door. His plan had worked. He half hoped Karen would find the kid's parents. He was feeling the slight bit of guilt and a subterfuge, but he knew she was capable of far trickier things than he could think of. He noticed a caddy standing in line waiting to tee off, lighting a cigarette. He walked over to the young man.
"Can I bum one off you? I quit this morning," he joked.
The kid gave a chuckle.
"Me too."
He shook out a slim white cigarette and Jake took it.
"Thanks."
"Need a light?" he asked.
Jake twirled the perfectly packed cylinder of tobacco in his fingers and inhaled deeply, imagining the smoke warming the back of his throat. He slipped it into his shirt pocket and nodded.
"Not now. I'll save it for later."
"Suit yourself," said the caddy as he took another long pull on his own butt.
"I won't smoke it until I sign Patterson,"
he promised himself. If only he could find him.
Thank you for listening to A Really Good Day, a novel by James Hosek, narrated by Rich Hosek.
If you're interested in purchasing a hardcover edition of this story for yourself or a golfer in your life, visit jimbooks.myshopify.com. You'll get free shipping in the United States. You'll also get the complete audiobook and ebook editions with your purchase. And make sure to subscribe to the mailing list for updates about the upcoming release of his Doctor at Mystery series, Cozy Mysteries About a Crime-Solving Veterinarian. Thanks again, and all the very best.